Both men were tired, and feeling secure behind the stout bolted door, they quickly fell asleep. There was a bright moon. Ryan lay still for a few moments, his eye taking in his surroundings. Something had disturbed him, and he wasn't quite sure what it was. One of the first things you learned about survival in Deathlands was that being awakened in the night in a strange environment could be profoundly hazardous. But that didn't mean you leapt into instant clumsy life. Better to take a dozen heartbeats and wait and watch, without giving a clue to anyone that you had actually returned from sleep. The square of the window was brilliantly lit, throwing a block of silver across the room, showing the door still securely locked and bolted. Ryan was aware of pressure on his bladder from drinking so much water over supper, and concluded that it could easily have been this that had awakened him. He could have taken the Sig Sauer and gone outside, but there was something about the short-sighted Malachi Gribble that he didn't quite trust. The second option was to piss out the window. Ryan recalled staying in a dormitory block in a ville down in the bayous, not all that long after he joined Trader and the pair of war wags. The local baron had been having trouble with stickies, having burned out a nest of the ferocious muties only a week earlier. Ryan and the others in the crews had been warned about going beyond the patrolled walls, particularly at night when stickies were likely to be out hunting. Jerzy Wajda had been a map reader and maker on Warwag 1, a tall, silent man with a hooked nose. He'd been one of the tiny number of people who'd fled the old world of Europe during the long winters and survived the almost impossible crossing of the Atlantic to make a fresh start in Deathlands. Jerzy was suffering from what one of the Warwag's medics said was a prostate problem, which meant he had to get up to take a leak several times during every night. He couldn't be bothered to go all the way to the Johns in the eastern section of the ville. He just opened the window without waking anyone and stuck it out, where a sticky was waiting. It reached up with the lethal sucking pads on its palms and fingers and ripped Jersey's genitals off his body. Shock and blood loss killed him within 80 seconds of the attack. Ryan decided not to risk taking a piss out of the window of the shack. There hadn't been any sign of stickies or any other muties in the region, and Gribble claimed that his only weapon was a ponderous black powder musket, so there wasn't that much danger around. He swung his long legs out of the bed, pushing back the mound of noisome blankets. It was cold, and Ryan could see his breath feathering out in a white mist, drifting into the area of bright moonlight. JB stirred a little, but lay on his back, hands folded across his chest like a statue on a medieval tomb. Ryan stooped toward the cupboard where he'd seen the chamber pot, opened the door, and took it out. He unbuttoned himself and held the pot in his left hand, controlling the amber stream with his right hand. When he'd finished, he placed the pot on the floor and buttoned his pants again. The floorboards creaked as they shrank in the chill of the night. Ryan bent down and carefully put the receptacle back into the cupboard, closing the door and straightening again, ready to climb back into the warm nest of blankets, when he hesitated.
What?
There'd been something glinting in the moonlight underneath the small cupboard. Ryan knelt again, reaching his right hand underneath the legs, feeling for what had caught his eye. His fingertips brushed the coldness of metal. He withdrew it and held it up to his eye to see it clearly, realizing immediately that it was a full metal jacket, 9mm round of ammo. A bullet for the sort of blaster that Malachi Gribble had denied owning. At that moment, Ryan's attention was caught by something else in the room. A section of the wall behind the beds was swinging silently backward on oiled hinges, revealing Gribble himself, holding an old Luger automatic in his right hand. Dean had persuaded Doc to go out with him from the safety of the house, leaving quietly an hour after supper was finished, to creep across the night coolness of the desert toward the campfires of the Slaves of Sin.
"Are you certain that young Master Lauren and Mistress Roth have given their permission for this shadowy enterprise, my dear boy?"
"Sure, Doc."
"What precisely is the point of this nocturnal expedition, if I may make so bold as to ask?"
Dean stopped and grinned at Doc as they paused by the fence that separated the old orchard from the pasture.
Sometimes you speak even odder than other times, Doc. Point is to go and take a look-see. See?
I suppose so.
We can loop around the arroyo to the north. Bring us close to where they are without them spotting us.
Unless the flagellants have taken the elementary precautions of placing sentries.
Yeah. I mean, no. Triple crazies like that need both hands to find their assholes, Doc.
If you say so, my gilded bird of youth, if you say so.
The wilderness seethed with nocturnal life. Dean led the way, moving at a fast crouch, followed by Doc, stumbling over the uneven terrain. An unidentifiable muty snake, 20 feet long, its skin black as jet with streaks of silver, slithered away from them, looping up and over the brim of the narrow draw. A pair of coyotes suddenly appeared ahead of them, eyes glinting in the moonlight like burned rubies. Dean halted, waving his Browning high power at the scavengers. For several long beats of the heart, the animals didn't move, crouching, bellies down, tails stiff. Their slightly open jaws dripped threads of pearly saliva into the dry sand.
Move!
The coyotes spun and loped off toward the north. Doc ducked as a hunting owl swooped low over his head, its great skull face as white as parchment, claws raking at the air just above Doc.
By the three Kennedys!
He wiped perspiration from his temples with his swallow's eye kerchief. Dean had persuaded him to leave the silver-headed cane behind at the house, but the commemorative Lama was snugly holstered at his waist, the hammer set over the single shotgun round.
Keep it down, Doc! Can't be more than 300 yards from their camp. I can taste their fires.
Doc tasted the air, nodding as he identified the familiar scent of burning wood. In the early days of his marriage, he and his young wife Emily had taken pleasure in going camping, an activity that most of their friends in 1890s Omaha regarded as being suspiciously bohemian. The smell of the fires brought back those happy times. The small two-person tent, its ridge throwing sharp shadows across the Box Canyon where they'd pitched it, a pot of fresh coffee brewed over the flames, their empty plates waiting to be washed in the nearby stream, the curved meerschaum pipe that Doc had favored in those far-off days, sending out plumes of smoke, keeping the invasive midges at bay. And he remembered Emily, her formal hiking clothes disarrayed, the collar of her silk blouse open, revealing the beginnings of the soft swell of her breasts, the roll of hair unpinned, tumbling about her shoulders, her ankle boots unlaced, her skirt pulled up to her knees as she relaxed.
Doc?
Doc saw the tenderness in his wife's eyes and the pouting smile half-teasing him, both of them knowing that the evening was nearly done. Soon they'd be snug in their tent, bundled together, gently exploring each other's bodies.
Doc, come on!
What is that?
Quiet!
Dean grabbed Doc by the arm, his fingers digging in hard.
You dropped off into a dream, Doc.
My sincere apologies, Dean. I shall do better and concentrate more. I promise you that.
The old man followed the boy as he crawled the last few yards, cautiously sticking his head above the top of the arroyo.
Dear Lord of Pain, aid us!
Shit!
Doc joined Dean, moving more slowly, looking out at the camp of the group of religious crazies, now less than 50 yards away from them.
My sweet Lord, it's like something from the fevered imagination of Bosch, the inner circles of hell. How can they...
There had been 14 of the slaves of sin, including their leader, the Apostle Simon. 13 of them now paced slowly around the large cross that had been dragged up to the house. Now the cross set upright in the sand, in front of the largest fire. And it had been put to use. The 14th member of the group was crucified upon it, dark blood showing black in the moonlight at the center of both palms and through the center of the crossed ankles. A crown of rusty barbed wire had been jammed over the man's head, leaving worms of blood to inch down over his agonized face. And someone had stabbed him in the side under the ribs, not hard enough to kill him, but enough to leave a gaping wound with glistening lips.
These people are in serious need of advanced and prolonged psychiatric counseling.
They're just sick stoops.
Perhaps we should return to the ranch now. I hardly think that they would welcome the knowledge that they were being watched in their disgusting